CNN Radio, I'm Cheryl Castro. New developments in the war in Libya. A United Nations envoy is expected in Tripoli to try to negotiate a ceasefire between Muammar Gaddafi's forces and rebel fighters. Demonstrations marking the anniversary of Israel's establishment and the displacement of hundreds of thousands of Palestinians have turned violent. Sirens rang out at a checkpoint in the West Bank near Jerusalem where Israeli soldiers clashed with Palestinian protesters. CNN's Rima Maktabi is at a Lebanese border town where she reports the violence is escalating.
We were hearing the gunshot. The protesters, Palestinian protesters, are just few kilometers away from the border, and the Lebanese army is deployed heavily on this border just to prevent any Palestinian or Lebanese or whoever from coming close to the Israeli border.
Three people were reportedly killed there. Israeli forces have also reportedly opened fire on a large group of Palestinians crossing a security fence along the border with Syria. Up to 20 people were injured. His attorney says the head of the International Monetary Fund will plead not guilty to attempted rape charges involving a hotel maid. Dominique Strauss-Kahn was arrested early this morning. Intentional flooding is expected to continue over the next few days with the opening of up to a quarter of the Morganza Spillway's floodgates. Waters are being diverted away from New Orleans and Baton Rouge. Marie Trahan's been busy sandbagging around her property along the Mississippi River.
God gave us the opportunity to prepare, and so that's what can be done. We can prepare the best we know how and the best we can, and hope for the best.
The river's expected to crest today in New Orleans at 17 feet and near Arkansas City at 53 feet. That's 16 feet above the flood stage. For news anytime, go to CNN.com. This is CNN Radio.
Here's another Home Depot advantage. A special buy on 1 1/4 cubic foot bags of Miracle-Gro potting mix for just $6.88. That's a guaranteed low price on organic soil proven to grow plants and vegetables up to twice the size. Find it lower anywhere else and we'll beat it by 10%, which means even bigger savings on even bigger plants. All thanks to Miracle-Gro potting mix for just $6.88. More saving, more doing. That's the power of the Home Depot. U.S. only. See store for details.
I understand
our differences.
I understand our similarities.
I understand
that my language can be yours.
That your language can be mine. And together we share something bigger.
I understand.
Understanding begins with language. Language begins with Rosetta Stone. Learn more at 1-800-915-4435. 1-800-915-4435.
This is Dan Tullis, and I just called
Joel Clark,
one of Select Quote Insurance Services Term Life agents.
Hi, Mr. Tullis.
Joel, how does Select Quote save you money on term life insurance?
Well, buying term life insurance is all about choosing the right company. Let's say you take antidepressants or you smoke. All insurance companies are going to price that differently. We'll impartially shop all the companies we represent to find you the best price.
Can you give me an example?
Sure. I just got a man, 40 years old, who takes blood pressure medication, a $500,000 policy with a highly rated insurance company. His price, $21 a month.
Call 1-800-500-0351 and see how affordable term life insurance can be. That's 1-800-500-0351. 1-800-500-0351. Or go to selectquote.com. We shop, you save. Get full details on the example policy at selectquote.com/commercials. Your price could vary depending on your health, issuing company, and other factors. Not available in all states.
Why should you take krill oil and omega-3 fish oil? Well, if you are concerned about any of the following, you should absolutely be taking both. And if you qualify, we'll even give you a risk-free trial of a pharmaceutical-grade fish oil combined with the super antioxidant power of krill. But first, you have to answer yes to one of the following. Are you concerned about your joint health? What about your memory and focus? Are you concerned about your heart health? Well, if you want to increase your joint comfort by 28% in just 7 days and promote memory, focus, and heart health, we're going to give you a free bottle of Krill Omega-3 Fish Oil. Just call this toll-free number and claim yours. 1-800-900-6118. We guarantee once you try Krill Omega-3, you won't believe the difference. That's why we're going to send you a free bottle just for calling. Call now for your free bottle and start easing sore joints today. Call 1-800-900-6118. 1-800-900-6118. 1-800-900-6118.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Executive Leaders Radio. In this hour, you'll hear directly from our region's finest business leaders. Through each of the interviews, these high-achieving leaders become relatable role models who share how they were able to build their enterprise, their personal secrets of success, about leadership styles, and opportunities that lie ahead. Prepare to be inspired, entertained, and to hear wisdom unheard elsewhere. Executive Leaders Radio.
You're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Mike Mannion. I'm joined by my co-host, David Cooper of the Bank of America, and we have a great lineup of guests for you today, including Alberto Gomez, president and founder of Prince Construction Company, Mike Weiss, the CEO of Video Labs, Jerry Johnson, general manager and CEO of the Washington Suburban Sanitary Commission, and Nick Bruno, owner of Barrister Digital Solutions. Let's get started by introducing to you our first guest, a gentleman by the name of Mike Weiss. Mike is the CEO of a company called Video Labs. Welcome, Mike. And what is Video Labs?
Well, thank you for having me. Essentially, Video Labs is a media services firm, and we specialize in helping others, primarily businesses, communicate their messages.
Okay. Can you give us an example?
Yeah. Well, we're sort of a soup-to-nuts media shop, a one-stop media shop, if you will, where we can take a message that you provide us, primarily a video message, and then manipulate it to make a compelling presentation and ultimately distribute it to 1 or 1 million individuals.
So what sort of companies use that service to create videos for their messages?
Most of our clientele is our corporations, organizations, government agencies, nonprofits, and broadcasters. So, for example, Discovery Communications, which has 10 or 11 different networks, will utilize us to make to take a message they have, a promotion of a of Shark Week, for example, mm-hmm. and make a number of copies to hand out to the press so they can preview it.
Fantastic. How big or small is your company?
Well, we're approximately 20 folks strong, okay. Looking to grow in the near future.
Got it. And Video Labs was founded when?
April of 1978, so we're 33 years old.
Okay. And how did you get a job there?
Well, I was recruited in 2000 to join the company to help them organize the wonderful work that presides within that facility.
Okay. I'm going to ask you to set false humility to the side. They saw something in you to go out and bring you in. What did they see in you?
Well, that's an interesting question, and it's hard to put humility to the side. But I can tell you that in a firm such as Video Labs, again, a media services firm, it's a creative environment, and it's not really a corporate organization. There's rules and structure, but within that group, you need to be able to relate to everybody and work within the confines of let's call it the KISS principle, keep it simple, stupid, mm-hmm. and not to demean myself or my company or anybody associated, but we keep everything on an even keel and a level such that we all understand what's going on. So
now in the green room, you answered this question by saying you were a goofy guy. Mm-hmm. Tell us what you mean by goofy guy.
Okay. I came from a corporate environment, having worked for ABC News for 10-plus years, and the suit and tie thing was nice in its confines, but in a small business such as ours, it doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. So I'm a coworker of everybody there. I like to mingle by the water cooler. I like to move my hands back and forth. I like to talk about the families of the individuals that work with me. And it all adds up to being sort of goofy. We do birthdays together. We're all in the same boat, doing the same thing. There's no pretense about ownership or low person on the totem pole.
Now that's really different than the stereotype of CEO as power broker or Gordon Gekko, for instance. Does your style really work?
It does, and it has to really. I am not comfortable in the Gordon Gekko style of doing business. I can relate on some level and be there when I need to be in certain situations. But for what we do, not necessary. I'm comfortable, and everybody around me is comfortable, including our clients and vendors, to be able to assimilate to my style.
Mike, who's had the most influence on you in forging your career?
Well, as you go through life, there are many influences that you have. But honestly, aside from my wife and kids, to my parents, that really had tremendous influence on me and enabling my stability that I feel that I have as a strong suit.
Stability? What do you mean?
Well, again, I'll relate this to my folks who have been married for 60 plus years and who created we just celebrated their 60th.
Wow.
Who they created such a warm environment for myself and my two sisters growing up in Long Island that we had such a good warm sense. They were so proud of us, and they led us to believe we can do anything that we wanted. And it was that I brought with me in everything that I did, knowing that I've got a good support unit, good backers, and if things didn't go well, they were there for me regardless. And
were you aware of how special that was even back when you were a child?
I was not aware of that until later in life, because I was fortunate to grow up in a middle-class community where I suspected that everybody had that sort of environment. I didn't think twice about it.
Yeah. What did your father do for a living?
My dad was the general manager of a cemetery, the largest Jewish cemetery in Long Island.
And is there anything interesting about having a father who does that kind of work?
Many interesting.
It's a little bit unusual.
To
give us one.
We don't have enough time now to go into all this, but I'll tell you a few things. Number one, he worked for 30-plus years at his company, retired, got a pension, ended up being on the board of directors. You find that very rare in today's environment.
Yeah.
Two, when we would learn how to drive, my sisters and I, he'd take us to the cemetery, and we would drive around what's in the cemeteries. Well, you know, and we would learn how to drive through the sites.
Well, why did your father choose that type of work?
I'm not sure he chose that type of work.
Yeah.
He was a product of the war, World War II, and somebody who he connected with. I can't remember who. It might have been an uncle of mine who led him to somebody who he knew, and it ended up at this organization.
So the value that your father most passed on to you was what?
Here's what my dad told me. He said to me, when I would ask him as a child, I would always say to him, "Are we rich, Dad?" It was always, as you're a kid, you're interested in sports and money and sex. And I said to him, "Are we rich, Dad?" And he said poignantly to me, looked at me, and he said, "We are rich. We're rich in love." And as trife as that may sound, that resonates now. And do I share that with my kids? You betcha.
Speaking of sports, Mike, you shared with us in the green room also one of your heroes growing up in the baseball side, and how some of his quotes just resonated through your career.
Yeah, I'm a sports aficionado. Maybe that sounds egotistical, but I'm big into sports, and I relate much of my business acumen and how I share things to my staff.
Lifelong Red Sox fan, I guess?
that would be the Yankees and the Nets and the Islanders and the Terps, where I went to college. So we don't want to talk about the Red Sox, but I certainly would bring up things like Bucky Bleepin' Denton, Aaron Bleepin' Boone, the Yogi Berra, who really, and you think about it, is probably the greatest philosopher of all time. Socrates and all these other guys I have no idea about. The stuff that comes out of Yogi, and you really think about it, makes a whole lot of sense. So his statement of "It ain't over till it's over" really is the thing that I sort of practice what I preach. And on my desk, in fact, in my office, there's a little slogan that says, "There's nothing less important than the score at halftime." And again, all this relates back to stuff that Yogi has said. And Yogi's birthday, I think, is May 8th, by the way, or May 6th, if anybody's interested.
Was there a time in your business career where you thought it was over? But it wasn't over until it was over, and you remembered Yogi's words. It impacted you.
Yeah, many times. And that could be as simple as having a bad day in the job and not liking the boss, or getting laid off. I've been there, too. Or in my present role as the owner of a company, having a client say, I'm not hanging with you anymore. it ain't over till it's over is really true, because if you're doing things right, you'll recognize that there may be something bad going on, but the game's not over.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about that sense of stability that you had mentioned earlier. You had a very, I don't know if it was a stable job, but certainly a very stable company with ABC. Yet for some reason, you decided that that wasn't where you wanted to be forever. Tell us more about that.
Well, interesting. It was the first job that I got out of college. 1984, finished college and got my job with ABC. And you can imagine a young person saying, oh, my God, this is out of control. Unbelievable. You're working for the network.
Yeah.
This is great. I'm on DeSalle Street in D.C. I'm right across from the Mayflower Hotel. And the celebrities and the news media is great to be around. And it wears off after a while. Now you're trying to learn your job and become really solid in the organization to make an impact. And over time, well, I could have stayed there for years and years, and in my belief, and got a pension and retired. I recognized that just wasn't enough. And while I was a stable individual and recognized that being at a place for a long time is wise, I also recognized that being of stable mind and body doesn't necessarily mean you don't want to advance over just getting over little hills. So I had to take a chance and learn more about the business world, and I was going to be the owner of a company someday. I knew that for a long time, and I had to leave ABC in order to get to that goal, and that's what I did. I left and moved on, got some experience, and networked my way into ultimately the position I'm in right now.
That is fantastic. Give us the website address for Video Labs, please, Mike.
It's videolabs.net. Plural, videolabs.net.
Thanks very much, Mike. We've been speaking with Mike Weiss. Mike is the CEO of Video Labs. I'd like to thank my co-host, David Cooper of Bank of America, for helping me structure the interview. Please don't forget to check out our website, www.executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders, and we will be right back in a moment after this important business spotlight.
Hi, this is Paul Smith from the Potomac Companies with your business spotlight, and joining us today is
Jessica Druckmann.
Jessica, and what company are you with?
I'm with Concero.
And Jessica, what is Concero?
Concero is a company that puts together events for senior-level executives. They're intimate, invitation-only, and take place over the course of 2.5 days.
So are these like CEO getaways to Las Vegas kind of things?
Not exactly. We actually say to leave your golf clubs at home. They are serious events. We bring executives together to network with each other, forge new relationships, benchmark, learn new ideas to bring back to their organizations.
Are there specific type of target companies you work with?
We aim for Fortune 1000 companies, the larger organizations for the most part. Most of our events are function-driven, so we put events together for general counsel, CFOs, CIOs, for example.
What do you enjoy most about your job?
What I enjoy most about my job is I have the opportunity to speak with and meet some of the most accomplished people. On top of that, when I'm at the events and meeting people and speaking with them and being in a room with executives all at the same level, sharing ideas and learning from each other, it's an amazing experience. And hearing from them that we've brought value to them, both to their organization and to enhance their career, is truly rewarding.
And Jessica, how can someone reach you?
They can reach me at jdruckmann@concero.com. Our website is www.concero.com.
This is Paul with your Business Spotlight. We've been speaking with Jessica from Concero. Have a great day. Bye-bye.
We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Mike Mannion. I'm joined by my co-host, David Cooper of the Bank of America. And it is my pleasure to introduce to you our next guest, a gentleman by the name of Jerry Johnson. Jerry is the general manager and the CEO of the Washington Suburban Sanitary Commission. Welcome, Jerry. And tell us something that we don't know about the Washington Suburban Sanitary Commission.
Well, how about in a nutshell, we are the single most important factor between good and bad health.
Wow. Tell us more.
We actually are a full-service provider of water and sewer services for Montgomery and Prince George's County, serving about 1.8 million customers. And we, on a daily basis, provide water to clean, safe drinking water to those customers. Never had a violation in 90-some years. And we also then take wastewater away from your homes and treat that wastewater through a chemical and a biological process and put it back into the receiving waters. And somebody downstream then gets that for reuse. There is no new water. We just keep recycling it over and over and over again.
So what would you say to the person, Jerry, who would say to you, well, how hard can that be? We don't live in an impoverished third world country. This is the United States of America. How tough can that be?
Well, having clean, safe drinking water and a way to dispose of it through the wastewater system is one of the reasons why we're not a third world country. That's one of the things that is a major division point. But we do take water out of the Potomac River and the Patuxent in Maryland. We treat that water through a chemical and filtering process, get all of the impurities out of it, make sure that it's clean and safe to drink, and then put it into a series of about 5,000 miles of pipeline and send it to Wow. individual homes. So we deliver it right to your tap. And then, when you're ready to get rid of it, we take it away through another Yes. series of about 5,000 or so sewage pipes and bring it into treatment facilities for disposal.
So clearly not as simple as it might appear.
Absolutely not. This is about a billion-dollar a year operation.
That's awesome. How long have you been the general manager and CEO?
Just over a year and a half at the Washington Suburban Sanitary Commission.
Okay. And you were where previously?
Prior to the Washington Suburban Sanitary Commission, I was at the District of Columbia Water and Sewer Authority, now known as DC Water.
Okay. And why the switch?
Well, over time, I was probably the longest-serving senior executive anywhere in the metropolitan area. The politics began to shift and change a little bit. There was an opportunity at WSSC. It's a little larger in terms of the population served and the customer base, and it presented some challenges that no longer existed at DC WASA, and so it was about time to make the move. When I first went to DC WASA, that was a bankrupt organization with no resources, and within about 2 years we turned it into an A-rated credit-rated utility with about $140 million in the bank, and those are the kinds of things that I enjoy doing, fixing things when they're not working well, and there was another challenge, so I decided to take it.
That is fantastic. Where did that ability to fix broken things come from?
Well, if I think way back, going into my own childhood, I guess, As a youngster, had to be pretty self-sufficient and independent in order to do the things that I needed to do for myself.
You said you had to be self-sufficient.
Yes.
Tell us more.
Well, I was raised in a single-parent home. My grandmother raised me. My grandmother had a fourth-grade education and took on the responsibility of raising me from an infant. She worked very hard to provide the very basics that were needed in the household for us to make it. And there came a point when I was big enough that I had to go out and start working on my own and begin to gather for myself, if you would.
Yeah. You said take care of us. You have siblings?
No, I'm an only child.
Okay.
I'm speaking of her and I.
Got it. Your grandmother, you said, had a fourth grade education. How did she know how to take care of all of these things, the jobs, how'd you figure out how to do that?
Well, I think it's the basic survival instinct probably was one thing. She's a strong black woman who recognized the need to get out and do the things she needed to do to survive. I think the other thing is that she had a very, very strong work ethic. And she always wanted something better for her children and for me as a grandchild who she was raising.
So what were some of the things you were doing to work to help the family when you were young?
Well, she and her sister and I used to clean a great big church. on weekends. I used to go and help do some of the work at some of the hot places that she worked. She worked as a domestic. And so as I got older, I began to go and do some of the heavy work, like scrubbing the floors and doing those sorts of things. I finally started my own little business. I had a little car wash business that I did when I was in high school, and worked at worked out of a mortician shop.
Wow! So, did it feel different to you having your own business at 16 than it did working for someone else at these very manual labor positions?
Well, absolutely. The greatest distinction, I guess, was being able to go and come and recognize that the harder I worked, the more I made, and that made a big difference, because doing the other things that I was doing and helping my my grandmother typically didn't bring any additional money in. She got paid the same piddly amount of money. She just had some help, so I was there to assist her.
Jerry, you mentioned there are a couple of other turning points that led to creation of what you are today.
Mm-hmm.
Could you get a detail on one or two of those for us?
Sure. I think that perhaps one of the turning points was during the time that I was in the military. I went to a segregated school system, so my neighborhood and the school that I went to, most of the people I interacted with were people of color, were African Americans like myself, and so it wasn't until I was in the military that I had a lot of exposure to white people, quite honestly. And you know, the general myth was that they were a little better, they were a little smarter, they could get things done, and the way that people got jobs and things like that, I mean, one would certainly think that from the town that I grew up in. And so all of a sudden there was the realization that, gee, I can do the same thing that these guys are doing, and I'm just as smart as they are. So why not look at more challenging kinds of things that I might be able to do after getting out of the military? So I was determined then that I would do something a little bit different.
Did that realization happen gradually, or was there some sort of a flashpoint where all of a sudden the light bulb went off?
Oh, the light bulb just went off. I mean, suddenly we were all being treated in the same fashion in basic camp. All of us had bald heads, the same uniform, going through the same exercise routine, the same learning routines that anybody else was. And so we were all brought to an equal level, which I had not experienced before. So that made a big difference.
So this made an even bigger difference than running your own business at age 16?
Oh, yes. Because that was, you know, that was something I had to do to survive. Let me find some way to go out here and make a honest living, because nobody was going to give a little black kid in Covington, Virginia, a job. The sign stayed up at the Micromac store for months at a time saying help wanted, and when you went in to talk to them about it, the job was always taken. So you can only get menial kinds of things to do as a high school student and a teenager. So I went to work in a body shop, working with a gentleman who was one of the leaders in the African American community, and I never will forget Mr. Slick Whitting. He gave me my first job sweeping the floors in his one of my first jobs sweeping the floors in his shop, and from there I got this interest in cars and started to branch out and figured I could do my own thing. But no, I don't think that I didn't have enough of a vision at that time to recognize that I was in business for myself.
Is it fair to say then that another turning point, which was Ebony Magazine, that gave you a vision?
Oh, yes. You remember that story,
I did. So tell us about that, please.
Well, you know, while I was in the military, one of the things that I was doing one day was looking at an Ebony Magazine. And it was it was just inspirational, I think, to see some of the people of color who were doing some of the things that they were doing, being in some of the places that they were in. And suddenly I looked at it and said, gee, why can't I do some of those same kinds of things? And why is it that I can't know some of these people who are in Ebony Magazine and who I'm seeing in here? So that it was really a turning point for me to say that, gee, my grandmother told me I could be whatever I wanted to be, so maybe I can do some of these things one day.
When did your grandmother realize that what she had told you all along, you could do anything you wanted to do, was coming true for you?
I think it was perhaps when I graduated from college, I would imagine, and took my first job where I was actually going to work wearing a tie. My grandmother, during the time that I was working my way through college, she was she loved me to death, and she told me as I was leaving, I don't have any money to give you. Don't know what I can do to support you, except I'll pray for you and know that I love you. And so I went off to do that. And during that time, I was a TV talk show host. I was a radio disc jockey. I was a gardener. I was a laborer. Wow. I was a salesman in a clothing store. I did a number of different things. And she was always amazed that I was doing these things. And she said, anything you put your mind to, you can probably do, as long as it's legal.
Jerry, give us the website address for the Washington Suburban Sanitary Commission.
The website address is wsscwater.com.
Okay, give us that one more time. Don't want anybody to miss it.
wsscwater.com.
Perfect.
Lots of information there. We invite you to tune in.
We have been speaking with Jerry Johnson. Jerry is the general manager and the CEO of the Washington Suburban Sanitary Commission. I'd like to thank my co-host, David Cooper of Bank of America, for helping me structure the interview. Don't forget to check out our website, www.executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders, and we will be right back in a moment after this important business spotlight. I'm Mike Mannion with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and this is your business spotlight. Today's guest is
Tim Keim.
And Tim, you're with whom?
Leadership Greater Washington.
And what is that?
We connect business leaders from business, government, nonprofit, get them collectively working together on issues facing Greater Washington.
Okay. There's a lot of organizations that sound like they do that. How is yours different?
Well, we focus on regional issues, focusing on making sure folks that work together should work together. We really believe in the power of relationships, so I'm kind of a matchmaker of folks who have influence, and we really kind of inspire their collaborative efforts.
So people or companies who would need that sort of help, give us some examples.
Well, anyone from a nonprofit CEO who's kind of siloed needs to connect with other folks, a business leader who has the ability to make change, or a government official needs to know more about what's going on, not just in his or her jurisdiction, but across Greater Washington.
Okay. Can you give us a success story?
Let me use the Fishing School. It is a nonprofit that helps folks in Northeast Washington focus on boys and girls getting after-school services. They were about ready to go under, but because their leader was in Leadership Greater Washington, got connected with business folks who transformed the organization, came in, did a business plan, did a marketing plan, communications plan, and now the organization has touched thousands more lives as a result.
Tim, what is your web address?
www.lgwdc.org.
We've been speaking with Tim Keim of Leadership Greater Washington. My name is Mike Mannion with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and that was your business spotlight. We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Mike Mannion. I'm joined by my co-host, David Cooper of Bank of America, and it is our pleasure to introduce to you a gentleman by the name of Nick Bruno. Nick's the owner of a company called Barrister Digital Solutions. Welcome, Nick. And tell us, what is Barrister Digital Solutions?
Well, Barrister Digital Solutions provides litigation support to law firms. We basically help law firms manage information.
Okay. Well, what does litigation support mean?
Well, when companies are litigating against each other, the amount of data that is produced as a result of the litigation needs to be managed.
Now, you drew some sort of an analogy when we were in the green room of the scope of this. Tell us a little bit about that analogy.
Well, you can take a hard drive, a terabyte worth of data, that the client really doesn't have an understanding of what's on that hard drive. What we do for them is cull that data down to a workable data set.
And if you were to take a terabyte of data and convert that into documents, hard copy documents.
We're talking millions and millions of documents.
Wow. So you take millions and millions of documents and sift through it and cull it down to something manageable.
That's correct. And then we take those documents and put it into a reviewable web-based platform, doc review platform.
Wow. How long have you been doing this?
I've been in the business since 1992.
Okay. How big or small is Barrister Digital Solutions?
Well, we have 30 employees, about 9,500 square feet in Washington, D.C.,
and you started your business at probably the most opportune time to start a business in history. Isn't that correct?
That's correct. I started my business on September 10th, 2001.
There's a lot going on in the news today, obviously, mm-hmm. about the following day. Tell us a little bit about the impact of September 11th on starting a new business, on you in particular, obviously.
Well, to be honest with you, it kind of put me at peace a little bit. I didn't put any kind of expectations on myself after that. To be honest, if this thing fails, it fails. But it was more sobering. I think it put it into perspective for me that, you know, starting and running my own business really isn't that big of a deal when this kind of thing happens. So just kind of roll with the punches and do the best that you can.
Wow, that's very interesting. You always wanted to be a business owner, is that right?
Yeah, I think ever since I was a kid, wanted to either own my own restaurant or be my own boss in some way, shape, or form.
Well, where do you think that desire came from?
I don't know. My parents were always telling me I could do anything I wanted to. My mother was a big influence on me. She was very confident in my abilities. I did well in just about everything that I tried, and she was very encouraging.
What did your mom do?
She processed loans, and she's been doing that for, 30 years now. So she was always working.
And your dad?
My dad's done a number of different things, bus driver, sold shoes. He's currently a mailman.
So we're going to get to that and your dad's influence on you in a moment. Tell us about one of the turning points in your life, please.
I guess one of the turning points in my life, especially when it comes to the business that I'm in right now is how I got hired to do what I do. I was a waiter at the City Club of Washington, and I was asked by management to go host the Gold Cup and to serve the beer and the wine at the Gold Cup for the members to come out to the tent. And I brought the beer and the wine out, and there wasn't any food set up. We weren't responsible for the catering, but as the members started to trickle into the tent, they noticed that the food wasn't ready, so they kind of took their anger out on me. So I had to go out and grab the caterer by the ear and bring him down to the tent to make sure that everything was set up. And my girlfriend at the time, my wife now, helped me set up the plates and all that stuff. And so we finally got everything put together. But the members, as they came in, weren't very happy with the situation. I got a real earful from one member particularly.
But that's not the end of the story, though.
The member happened to be somebody who was trying to recruit one of the top sales reps from a competitor of his. So he was trying to sway him to come to his company. And as a result of that berating I took at the hands of the member came back to me shortly after that and said that the guy that he was trying to hire wants to come work for him, but under one condition, that I would be his customer sales rep because of the way I managed myself under that pressure situation.
So. Talking about making a good impression on someone. What do you think he saw in you?
I think it was, not cracking under pressure, being respectful, being professional in the face of somebody who was really upset. And I think the type of business that we're in with the litigation support, it's a pressure cooker. And I think the potential sales rep really saw that I could handle myself in that kind of a situation.
Yeah.
And it was tough to take, but I'm glad I did it.
And you evolved from there. You opened offices in this area for other companies, et cetera?
Yeah, I started out as a customer service rep, basically dogging boxes. Quickly moved into sales, one of the top sales reps in the nation. Then I went into sales management. Then I became managing partner of shops. Companies would ask me to come in and save certain shops to make them more profitable. Other companies would ask me to start brand new shops. And from that experience, I decided I could do this on my own.
Yeah, you mentioned the word pressure cooker a moment ago. There was a bit of a pressure cooker family situation growing up, was there not?
Yeah, I went through a divorce. You know, my parents divorced when I was 15, 16 years old, and I think that was kind of a turning point for me as well.
How so?
Well, I guess, you know, just like everybody, all the boys want to impress their fathers in some way, shape, or form, and I think that enhanced that part of me wanting the desire to please my father.
Yeah. You spent some time with your father working. Tell us about that, and tell us about trying to impress him.
Well, we sold shoes together at Hans Shoe Store. I got my first job running stock at Fair Oaks Mall, and then I started to sell with my father at Seven Corners. And, yeah, I mean, I was one of the top reps there, and a part of me wanted to show my dad that I could do this and be good at it, and I was.
So you showed him?
I did. I showed him, and I continue to show him. And, you know, everything, you know, in the back of my mind, I think that's one of the reasons, that's the driving force sometimes, is to get his approval.
Did he give you his approval?
Oh, yeah. He's very proud of me. He tells me all the time. He helps. He guides me in some of the business decisions that I make. And so, you know, I'd like to communicate with him more, but, you know, we talk from time to time.
This is very interesting to me. Your father was selling shoes.
Mm-hmm.
I don't forget what you said he did right after that, but he's a mailman now, and he gives you business advice.
Sure.
Your dad must be a pretty wise and smart guy.
Well, yeah, he was in a high level management position with Red Shoe, Hans Shoe Store. Mm-hmm. So now he knows how to manage people. He knows how business operates. He understands what's important to customers, and you know, he sees the future. You know, he's the one who really prompted me to get serious about getting into the digital aspect of my business, get into the technology part of my business. He's always been encouraging.
If I follow your career trajectory, so you were selling shoes, you were a waiter at an outdoor catering event, you were, to use your words, dogging boxes this job and doing some grunt work, I'm assuming, and now you're a business owner of a seemingly pretty, not only successful, but sophisticated type of service. How in the world did that happen?
Well, you know, once you run and operate these businesses, you really get in tune to the cost structure, what the expenses, what do they mean? How does that impact your bottom line? And when you can start to add things up and go, well, this costs this, and I can generate this kind of revenue, this makes sense to me. I can make a margin here. I can make profit on this. And when you're running these things, your boss is asking you to create profit, so you figure out how you create profit. And so from there, I think that's how it kind of clicked. Hey, I can do this on my own.
So you learned how to be a businessman on your own, on the fly.
Well, I learned to be a businessman through the mentoring of my bosses. So I want to give, you know, those folks credit as well. They had patience, and they, you know, answered questions that I had about depreciation and things of that nature. And so no, I won't take the credit. I'll give a lot of the credit to my former bosses, really.
One of the things I've heard about being a waiter is that a lot of people, once a waiter, they stay a waiter because it's quick cash and it's, you know, a pretty substantial amount of money depending on where you're working. Why did you not just max out there, but you continued to grow and have a higher vision?
Well, actually, I worked for Club Corporation of America. It's a nationally known, world-renowned company that basically manage private clubs.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I was on a path to be, you know, I was a captain of the wait staff, which meant that I managed the wait staff. The next step would be a maitre d', and then from there I could manage my own restaurant.
Yeah.
And I seriously considered doing that, and it was a really tough decision to go from being a captain, which was a little bit higher than a waiter, to go into a totally different industry that I had no idea about. So it took some courage to do that, but I'm glad I did it.
Yeah. So the entire trajectory, even though from the outside it may not have been obvious that you had a vision of being a business owner, you always kept that vision of being a business owner through all of those positions?
Yeah. I think what was appealing to being a part of a restaurant is that maybe eventually that I would understand and learn the inner workings of a restaurant and have my own one day. I mean, everything that I've ever done, I've tried to do the best that I can in hopes that maybe I can take it from there and do my own thing.
So what does your father think of his business owner son?
I think he's proud of me.
You think, or you know that for a fact?
Well, he doesn't, you know, doesn't talk much to me, so I mean, I take that back. We need to talk more.
Yeah. But he knows you're successful.
Yeah, he knows that we're successful. I'm going to see him tonight, as a matter of fact.
All right. Well, ask him that question. How am I doing, Dad?
Yeah.
Would you please give us the website address for Barrister Digital Solutions?
www.barristerdigital.com.
Okay. Could you spell that? Barrister is not a word.
BARRISTERDIGITAL.
And give it one more time without the spelling.
BarristerDigital.com.
BarristerDigital.com. Yep. Thanks very much. We've been speaking with Nick Bruno. Nick's the owner of Barrister Digital Solutions. Forgive me. I'm going to give you that one more time. Barrister Digital Solutions. I'd like to thank my co-host, David Cooper of Bank of America, for helping me structure the interview. Do not forget to visit our website, www.executiveleadersradio.com, to check out more of our executive leaders. And we will be right back in a moment, right after this important business spotlight. This is Mike Mannion of Sirius Interim Executive Solutions. This is your Business Spotlight. Today's guest is?
Frank McMillan.
And Frank, who are you with?
A company called PeopleShare.
PeopleShare. Well, what is that?
We're a full-service staffing company.
And what does full-service mean?
Well, we work with people for clerical, admin, light industrial. We're specialized in the legal side, call center staffing.
Given the economy, are people still using staffing companies right now?
Absolutely. We are growing tremendously right now.
So a typical customer for you would be who?
A lawyer's office, any call center, manufacturing facility that is growing or needs to hire some new individuals.
Yeah. Can you give us a success story?
Well, we have a lot of success stories. One of them is just a lot of the people that come into our office just don't interview well. And they just don't have the opportunity to get in to a location, and we give them that first step into the facility. So, it kind of gives them a helping hand to get into a premier company, and then they see their work values and ethics, and then they hire them on as a full time employee.
Why do you feel this is such important work to do?
Well, I really enjoy this because. Both sides of the customer, the company that I am recruiting for, and the employees that come in, both benefit tremendously from the efforts that I do. So it's very important.
Are there particular types of clients that you look for?
Light industrial and manufacturing are some very important clients, but call center work is very nice too.
Frank, would you give us your website, please?
It is PeopleShareWorks.com. That's www.peopleshareworks.com.
This is Mike Mannion with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and that was your Business Spotlight. We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is Mike Mannion, your host, and I'm joined by my co-host, Steve Abramowitz with Accelerant. And we were expecting to talk to Alberto Gomez, president of Prince Construction. Something's come up, and we'll be talking with Alberto at another show. Instead, we're speaking with a gentleman by the name of Ned Johnson. Ned is the CEO and founder of a company called Prep Matters. Welcome, Ned. And what is Prep Matters?
Thanks very much, Mike. Quick correction, president and tutor geek. I'm a guy who spends all day long helping people take standardized tests. Prep Matters is a group of folks who are professional tutors and educational planners. We help people through all of the various tests and all the steps along the way to get from where they are to the schools that they want to attend.
Can you give us an example?
Sure. Well, I spend all day sitting shoulder to shoulder with teenagers, helping them take the SAT. It's test prep therapy. It's not only teaching them how to do the Pythagorean theorem and what loquacious means, but talking about the concerns they have, and an older brother who was a rock star on this test, and gosh, can I ever do as well? And mom's really breathing down my neck. And we sort of break things out piece by piece and say, here's the plan, here's the goal, and if we do these things one part at a time, we'll get you to where you need to be.
How big or small is Prep Matters?
There are about 40 of us, mostly tutors, some admin folks, some counselors.
And you've been around for how long?
We incorporated in 97, so we've been doing this for a while. I started doing test prep right out of college in 93. So
wow.
I've got plus or minus 30,000 hours one-on-one with kids. So,
well, when you were describing or giving your example, two things came to my mind. Number one, it sounds like you're almost a psychologist or a psychoanalyst, number one. And number two, I think most adults would be running and screaming away as fast as they could if that's what they had to do, especially for a living. What makes you crave doing this?
Well, you know, it's interesting for me. I think I'm sort of the Dick Clark of test preparation. For me, teenagers, and it may be arrested development, but teenagers are a really interesting group. I mean, they're kind of this crossroads of their lives where they're nearly fully functioned adults and they're looking forward to all the things in front of them. And it's an exciting time, but it's also a scary time. And parents are trying to help kids be successful, but they want to let go of the reins so kids can do things on their own, but they're also afraid, what if they, drive it right into the ditch? And so to be a concerned adult who is there shoulder to shoulder with them, and I am invested in nothing but their success, I'm not simultaneously reminding them to clean up the room or to, write a note to Aunt Jenny. It's just, here's what we do, here's the goal, and I'm right there with you.
So how did you get started doing this?
Oh, it's a long story. I mean, two parts. One, I started doing this, my wife, then girlfriend, started dating her in college, and she was in charge of a test prep group that went to local high school and gave free tutoring to kids, and so I had an interest in having her approval, and so went along basically tutoring kids and whatever they needed help with. So when I graduated college and was looking for the right job, this opportunity working for another company just sort of came by, and thought, I know how to do that.
Is it true that you actually have gotten perfect scores on some of the exams that you tutor for?
That is true. I go and take these tests shoulder to shoulder with kids so that I can talk, I think, with some authority, not only about the content, but about what these things feel like. My colleague and I wrote a book about called Conquering the SAT, and it's all about the stress, how stress and anxiety can undercut performance on the SAT, just like it might in, say, golf. And so I discovered the value of actually sitting for these tests so I can keep reminding myself of what it feels like to be under that pressure. Happily, I've conquered those pressures myself, I suppose, and can get perfect scores, when I sit for these things.
Ned, all false humility to the side. Are you a genius, and that's why you're able to get perfect scores on these tests?
Very, very kind. I had a colleague, a parent, come through and said, "I understand you're the smartest man in the world." And I took a big, deep breath and looked at him and said, "Boy, I hope not." And my take on this is this stuff is all learnable. I mean, they're standardized tests, so they test the same kind of thing over and over. And it's simply a matter of you study this like you might study mathematics or how to be a better writer or how to play tennis. Ideally, I'm a good coach, and I tell people what they need to know and how to study in the most effective way. So I'm convinced that anyone could eventually get pretty darn close to perfect. It's just that's not the goal. The goal is to get scores that help you get into the colleges that you want, and the rest of it, whether it's a test of IQ, that stuff is all just rubbish as I see it. I'm just simply here to help people close the gap so they get the scores they want, so they get the college choices they want.
How do you navigate through some of the family dynamics and the teenage dynamics as they all battle with each other to interfere with a student's ability to concentrate or do well?
Well, some of it is a lot of it is, I think, for kids to be heard without being contradicted is a big part of it. Just letting kids tell you what their concerns are, and part of the approach that I have with kids is say, whatever the concerns are, say, those are completely normal. You are completely normal. Everybody has those reactions, and then whether it's telling a foolish story about myself or about a student who I've shepherded through this process before, I mean, it's like kids going to dances in junior high, and everyone is self-conscious and thinks everybody's looking at me, oh my gosh, and we realize everyone's having the exact same experience. And so for kids to be able to talk about their concerns and mom and dad's, and we end up just sort of reframing it. Well, my mom's all over my case and da-da-da. It's like, yeah, I know, Mike. The deal is just your mom cares so much about your success, and she can't help it. She's just pushing a little bit. And if you can just read that as she cares, and we'll figure out a way to get her to back up and give you a little bit of space as well, but to help them reframe what they're hearing in a way that they can simply set it aside, get out of the way, and get back to the matter at hand.
Talk about push, push, push. You mentioned that you're an identical twin and that you and your twin don't necessarily have the stereotypical relationship that we assume most twins do. Tell us about that.
Well, no secret language, regrettably. That would have been really cool. I think we needed an older sister to gang up on. I went to a tiny public high school in a tiny little town in rural Connecticut, and so we were together all the time, because when, if you're in honors this and that and French too, then all of a sudden all you have the classes align. And so we were together 24/7, which has its own sets of challenges, but we also didn't want to be a unit. We didn't want people to think of us as one person. We don't share, you know, we don't each have half a brain. So how do have our own identities and our own spheres, even though we were constantly around one another? Kind of an interesting challenge.
Was it easy to find those separate identities, or was it hard?
You know, it's hard to say. I mean, I don't have an experience different from what I had. We got pretty good at reading one another and trying not to step on one another's toes too much. You know, trying to read, you know, oh, he's got a crush on her. I better step back and give him some space to go talk to that girl. This kind of thing. So we weren't kind of wrecking one another's lives.
Did people perceive you as sort of being carbon copies of each other, and you needed to fight against that?
Yeah, I mean, that's a natural tendency, because we look a lot alike and our voices sound the same and all this kind of jazz. And so, yeah, I mean, it's a natural tendency.
So being able to have your own identity from someone who looks and talks exactly like you, what does that have to do with helping students excel on the SAT and other tests?
Well, I think it's sort of back to the question that Steve asked. You know, kids often... They think of themselves relative to other people. So my brother does piano. Well, I'm not going to play piano because I'll never catch up to him. And so within family dynamics, it's often, who am I relative to mom and dad? Who am I relative to my brothers and sisters? And I mean, I had one of my favorite stories this kid years ago. And she came in and she had SAT scores that, you know, 800 is perfect. You don't know that. She had scores that are a little under 600. So we're trying to get them up in the mid sixes. And she's making great progress. And she gets up the mid sixes. And I'm like, this is fantastic. You're going to do great on this. And she looks at me like, no, that's not going to happen. And it took me a while to figure this out. But she has this older sister who's sort of classically geeky, very bookish, very successful in school and all this kind of stuff. And for my students, we'll call her Jenny, in Jenny's mind, her older sister was the smart one. She had to be something different. But she was really bright, and so over time, you know, and very hardworking and doing everything we wanted, and I kept saying, no, you can do this, and I, when I finally figured out that's what it was, I said, I'm sorry, I got it, right, because that's what genes work, right? I mean, all the smart genes were given to your sister, and they're just the dregs that left over here, and made her... And basically said, look, you can still be, you know, kind of cool and funky and not geeky the way your sister is. And you can just kind of be a closet geek, but you have a really good mind. So darn it, let's still be hip, but let's go and smack this test. And when she could think about it this way, she didn't have to be your sister. She didn't have to compete with that. We're just looking at the test. And she eventually went off, got some crazy good score, calls me up on vacation, says, I got a 1440. I said, I told you so, and I hung up the phone.
Ned, I think you've convinced all of us that, number one, you are a test geek, and number two, you really love kids and have a passion for them. Why run a business, though? Why not just do this on your own?
Interesting question. You know, the first year I did this, I had some early successes that got me a lot more referrals. And by the end of about 6 months of this, I was sitting there on Saturday morning tutoring, honest to God, 6:30 in the morning until 7 o'clock at night, hour after hour after hour. And it doesn't scale well. There's no place I could go. And I was dreadfully terrible at saying no to anyone. And so I decided, you know, I really had a choice. What am I going to do here? And turning people away didn't seem like the right thing to do. So I found other folks who also like kids, who are, you know, into this kind of stuff. And we can simply help more people this way.
Yeah. Ned, would you give us the website address for Prep Matters, please?
Sure. It is www.prepmatters.com.
Okay. Just to make sure we all get it, give it to us one more time.
Sure. It's www.prepmatters, P-R-E-P, as in preparation, and then matters, M-A-T-T-E-R-S.com.
Fantastic. Thank you. We've been speaking with Ned Johnson, CEO of Prep Matters. I'd like to thank all of our guests today, including Nick Bruno, CEO of Barrister Digital Solutions, Jerry Johnson, General Manager and CEO of the Washington Suburban Sanitary Commission, Mike Weiss, CEO of Video Labs, and of course, most recently, Ned Johnson, CEO of Prep Matters. I'd like to thank my co-host, Steve Abramowitz with Accelerant, for helping me structure the interview. Don't forget to visit our website, www.executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. We have been broadcasting from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Mike Mannion. Thank you for listening. Most of all, I want to thank our listening audience. Without you, we would not even have a radio show. Have a great day, folks. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to Executive Leaders Radio, the region's premier radio show highlighting local executive leaders. We hope you've enjoyed the show here on Federal News Radio. You can learn more about Executive Leaders Radio by visiting executiveleadersradio.com or tune in next time right here on Federal News Radio. That's executiveleadersradio.com.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWTFM HD2 Manassas, WTOPFM HD2 Washington. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of Washington Nationals baseball, Washington Capitals hockey, the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, and American University Eagles basketball. Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m., the Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics, and your source for federal news now.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
For 45 years, people have relied on Village Green Apothecary to give them individualized nutrition, pharmacy, and healthy living products. Village Green will give you the kind of person-to-person help and attention that mass-market pharmacies have long ago forgotten. You can depend on us for knowledge, experience, product selection, and a smile. Visit Village Green in Bethesda at 5415 West Cedar Lane. Call us at 301-5415.